Good evening. You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman. We are the audio mirror of the Gallatin Valley. Run your radio dial at 95.9 FM and we're online at kgvm.org. It's time now for health and happiness here on KGVM.
Another presentation of Health and Happiness is coming your way. I'm Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist. With Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist, we happily broadcast on KGVM 95.9 and KGVM.org. Listen on Monday evenings, 7 p.m., Thursday mornings at 9, or go on to KGVM.org and look up the present or any of the past programs. The Montana Psychological Association Public Education Committee supports us, and we emphasize all kinds of health and happiness issues, especially regarding mental health. Dr. Suzanne now presents today's program.
A primary concern for each of us is the health status of our families and of ourselves. We, for example, watch Isabella, our family darling, soon to have her first child. We are thrilled with the excellent medical care she's receiving. But should we be very concerned she could be exposed to measles since she lives in Texas? It may just be a 3 days inconvenience for all but 1% of children. But for a baby in the womb who is exposed, it can be disabling, disfiguring, and even deadly. We have a medical champion here with us today, Dr. Christina Myers, to discuss this and other current and vital concerns for our health and the current status of healthcare in America. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you so much for having me.
And just as a reminder to our listeners, you've been here before, but tell us where you work and a little bit about the facility, if you would.
Absolutely. We've actually undergone a little bit of a change in the last year. So I work at what's always been known as Community Health Partners. We had to merge with another federally qualified health center called One Health. So we are now One Health, the West Region, which is called Community Health Partners. It's a little bit more complicated. But we offer the same great services as a federally qualified health center. We offer medical, behavioral health, and dental care. We have clinics in Bozeman, Belgrade, and Livingston. And we used to have a clinic down in West that is now only currently able to offer behavioral health services, not medical services anymore. But we offer care to anybody regardless of their ability to pay. We accept all forms of insurance. And for folks who don't have insurance, we help them to see if they would qualify for coverage, or they can sign up for our sliding fee scale to pay a discounted rate based on income.
That's so excellent to hear. And we would like to take a moment here to testify that we go to that clinic, and it's been absolutely top-notch medical care for like 8 years now. And we want to thank you for all of the wonderful professionals and services you've put together. Tell us, I think you even have a pharmacy. Tell us, and counseling, which is significant. So, yes, when people go to this clinic, there's a variety of support that's available.
Yes, both the Bozeman and Livingston clinics have an on-site pharmacy, which you can utilize whether you're a patient at Community Health Center or at Community Health Partners or not. And the pharmacy also are experts in navigating our complicated healthcare system and helping to hopefully find best prices and help people afford medications that have been recommended for them, which is a complicated system.
Well, and according to the Gallup survey on aging, speaking of one group of folks, about 1 in 3 U.S. older adults did not seek health care in the prior 3 months due to cost, including 8.1 million Americans 65 and older. And so, and also 31% were highly concerned about their ability to pay for medications they might need. So it's particularly salient and helpful that you all work to offset the medical costs that people cannot reach or, you know, are terrified to go in and check with medical practitioners because of.
Yes, it is a really important issue for everyone's health. I can remember back to when the Medicaid expansion first went into place, which has been about a decade now. So many people who hadn't had basic medical coverage for a really long time all of a sudden had coverage. And it was a bit overwhelming to try and address all these problems that have been percolating for, you know, someone's lifetime and they've never sought medical care. Whereas if we can focus on prevention and early diagnosis, people will stay healthier longer, but we have to have the coverage to get people there and help people to understand how important that prevention is.
And it almost seems to me that we could most likely reduce medical costs if we did a lot more prevention and early treatment and diagnosis.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, we just might march on to one of the questions we had in mind today, which is, what vaccinations would you think that we should all take?
Oh, goodness. That is a whole list. We started, or you started the conversation kind of thinking about your expecting daughter in Texas, and part of routine prenatal care is to screen for immunity to specifically rubella, but the measles vaccine is a combination vaccine that has antibodies for measles, mumps, and rubella. And if women are found to not be immune to rubella during their pregnancy, it is recommended that they receive a booster vaccine, the MMR vaccine, immediately after they deliver. The vaccine isn't considered safe during pregnancy, but if you give it right after, then you can transmit some of that protection to your baby. The MMR vaccine is a part of the routine schedule that children would get after their first birthday and then again before starting school. And something else I think that is really important to consider in which vaccines we should get is just staying up to date with booster vaccines over your lifespan. In Gallatin County, over the last year, we've had a resurgence of pertussis, and there was a pertussis outbreak this year that affected the university and the high school in town and spread throughout the community. Pertussis is a part of your tetanus booster that is recommended to get every 10 years. So when you get your Tdap, your tetanus, diphtheria, and acellular pertussis vaccine every 10 years, that should keep you protected against pertussis.
Tell us and exactly, then, what is pertussis?
Pertussis is also known as the 100-day cough. It's a bacterial illness that really just starts as a pretty mild cold in most people. And that's, of course, when you're transmitting it to others, it's spreading around the community. But then it ends up having this latent phase where people have coughing fits. And classically, that leads to vomiting, this like after cough or post-tussive emesis, because of the very thick phlegm that goes along with a pertussis infection. And that will resolve without treatment, but it takes 3 to 4 months for complete resolution.
Gracious.
Antibiotics are effective in treating pertussis, but you have to take them early. So you have to sort of be aware that there's transmission in the community, be suspect of it, to test for it and treat for it in people that you think might have been exposed.
Well, you know, we all think of protecting ourselves with vaccines, but there's another very important factor at work here, and that is that when we get vaccinated, we protect others. Vaccines lower the chance that you or child will spread a disease from the Mayo Clinic, and this is important because some people can't get vaccines or don't have a strong immune response to vaccination. Newborns and older adults are in this category. Others who benefit from having only vaccinated people around them include people being treated for cancer, taking medications that lower the immune response, people who've had transplants, and people managing a chronic illness such as diabetes. So these folks all rely on others to get vaccinated and prevent the spread of disease, along with every pregnant mother. Because as I read this morning, there's no cure for in utero measles if it impacts that baby trying to be born.
No, there isn't. And there isn't a cure for measles for anyone. Really, prevention is key with measles. Once you're infected and sick, managing the symptoms is the cornerstone of treatment. But prevention is really key. And this is one of those immunizations that has been shown to be really effective. Measles was felt to be eradicated from the United States in 2000, 25 years ago. And we've had sporadic cases since then that generally have been attributed to international travelers bringing measles with them on their travels. But this outbreak that we're seeing now in the United States, which is nearing 500 cases and has had 2 fatalities, has really been allowed to happen because of exactly what you were just talking about, Dr. Woods, that lack of herd immunity. There's enough people in those populations that aren't immunized that's allowing the spread of this highly contagious airborne virus. It's thought that the virus can be contagious even 2 hours after the infected person has left the room. And 9 out of 10 people who are unvaccinated and exposed to measles are going to get sick. It is one of the most highly contagious illnesses that we know of.
Those who have gotten measles, what percentage of them were vaccinated?
The data that I've shown, most people's vaccination status is listed as unknown. 97% are listed as unknown, which probably means unvaccinated. And 2% of people who are sick only received 1 of the 2 recommended doses, and 1% report being fully vaccinated. So a very low percentage of vaccinated people are getting sick. It's people who are vaccine status unknown, which likely is unvaccinated.
So if you get the vaccine appropriately and keep it up the way you should, it's almost 100%.
Yes, it's very effective.
And I'm hearing from this that you would recommend that young women who think they might get pregnant or who are planning on getting pregnant or even who aren't planning, surprises do happen, they should have a measles vaccination if they haven't had them previously.
Yes, it would be great for everybody to know what their vaccination status is and to get vaccinated if they didn't receive that usual dosing as a child at 1 and 5 years of age.
Are there booster shots recommended now for measles if you had the vaccines long ago? I'd read something about that. What do you think about that, Dr. Myers?
I have also read about that consideration too. It, as of right now, is not recommended to do unless you know that you're not immune. But it's also thought to be pretty low risk, that if people felt like they needed a booster, they were uncertain and weren't able to test for immunity. But I haven't seen that as a new recommendation yet to get a booster for everybody.
So we're really pretty fine with our long ago inoculations because they're that effective.
That's yes, great. For most people, it gives you lifelong immunity.
We really appreciate hearing about that. And we hope that, you know, with all the talk in the world today, some people are shying away from vaccinations. And I just think that your comforting information about the need to go ahead and check this out. You can look in all sorts of resources and find information about vaccinations. And here we have Dr. Myers explaining to us how valuable and pure gold the vaccinations are, in particular with measles, which has an outbreak across the U.S. right now, but with many other illnesses like the pertussis.
Yeah, it's really amazing how incredibly effective vaccines are, that a lot of people who are concerned about the safety of vaccines, that worry really, I think, comes from a lack of knowledge about the diseases that these vaccines have been so effective in treating. You know, we hadn't seen measles. People sort of forgot about how serious of an illness it can be. And so the feeling is, well, it's not that important. It's not around. I don't need to vaccinate my children for this. And we're seeing, you know, the effects of that with these outbreaks. Similarly with the polio vaccine, which has been extremely effective in eradicating polio, really almost globally. There's a lot of misinformation out there about how it's not necessary, and we'll just see it come right back. These diseases are still out there, and when that herd immunity lapses, it gives them the opportunity to come back again.
Tell us what happens in a good, healthy case of polio. I had a person not long ago say, oh, it's just like a mild flu. Yeah.
It's so hard because, you know, especially with viral illnesses, for some people, that is the case, that polio is a mild disease. And also, polio can be a very severe disease that can impact your nervous system and leave people with post-polio syndrome, where they have, you know, neurologic deficits that can impair your ability to even walk.
Yes, I have a fellow speech-language pathologist who had polio as a child and had very difficulty learning to walk and being able to walk with a considerable limp, and as she got older was no longer able to continue standing up on her feet and walking. She had to go to a wheelchair, but I mean, it can be more severe than paralysis and all. It can be totally severe from what I understand.
Yes, I mean, it can affect your whole, it can be localized to a specific set of nerves that would potentially affect your gait. And then it can also get into the central nervous system and affect your whole body and your ability to even breathe.
The iron lung was something that I was aware of in growing up. If people have that type of response to the polio germ, that isn't still used, or is it?
That is a great question. I am not sure. I think it probably would have been replaced by intubation if that were necessary at this point, but I don't know.
Yeah.
It's, again, one of those mm-hmm. things that I have not in my career ever seen, but have learned about. And I do know a couple people that have had polio that are older than me and had polio as children and have lifelong deficits from that.
Well, and it's good that they have a lifelong, because many people died from polio when Arliss and I were young.
No, I remember you talking about in previous episodes that we've done together, you know, that difference that you remember from everybody lining up at the pool to receive their polio vaccine to the hesitancy that has happened with our most recent vaccine development for COVID. It's a pretty different culture around vaccines currently.
It was so desperate, I recall. Nobody could go out much. That, like, the movies closed, the swimming pool closed for swimming. You couldn't go play with other kids. And as people got sick, there was no effective treatment. Even the president got polio, and it was terrifying. Everybody was so frightened. And boy, everybody lined up that we knew when there was a way to circumvent and to triumph over that terrible, terrible, crippling illness.
Yes. And actually, I was just sort of reading about polio as we've been talking. And it does say in here, approximately 70% of polio infections are asymptomatic, but those asymptomatic people can still shed disease. And 24% of people have sort of minor, non-specific illnesses. And then the remaining folks can have severe disease that affects meningitis or causes your, can cause meningitis and affect your central nervous system. And then the paralysis as well that can happen in people that is usually permanent.
This whole anti-vaccine movement has fascinated me and shocked me when it seems logical to have a vaccine if you don't want to have an illness. I find at the center of that, as far as I can tell, that one of the main things is, oh, it's my individual right not to be told what to do, and I can take it if I want or not want, and it's just an individual freedom. Yet, obviously, that goes against the idea of, well, what about the group that you live in? What about the others? I shouldn't be forced to do this because I don't want to. Or then there's some paranoia associated with it, like, well, is it really someone trying to put something in me that for like mind control or some other kind of control over me? And so I find it shocking that people would buy into that. But obviously, a great number of people have. But it's kind of group versus individual. And I don't think I have an individual right to infect the people around me, though. But how do you look at that philosophically?
I mean, I think it's just been a real cultural shift. In the United States, that kind of goes across many different facets of our lives. We have this kind of individual focus, different from community well-being. And I don't know that it serves us well. You know, there's this epidemic of loneliness out there. People feel disconnected. And I think that this sort of individual over the collective good mentality kind of goes along with that, you know, to our own health detriment, as we're not looking at the whole community as being an important part of each individual's survival. Unfortunately, I did read recently that some of the funding cuts that are happening on the federal level are affecting research into vaccine hesitancy, trying to better understand where this mentality comes from so that we can, you know, more appropriately educate people on the safety and efficacy of vaccines. I feel like that is going to be very impactful in healthcare professionals really having the tools they need to educate their young families and kind of combat misinformation that's out there around vaccines. I think this is going to cause some trouble down the line with our safety and well-being.
With the massive federal employee and federal funding cuts, is that affecting the funding for the federally qualified health centers?
It certainly can. So on the day that that executive freeze went out on all federal grants, our clinic did not have access to its bank account that it uses to pay bills. Fortunately, that was restored by the end of that one business day, and those grants are still in place with our current continuing resolution budget that's been passed through September. But One Health's budget, 70% of that comes from a federal grant. So if those grants go away, our federally qualified health centers will have to close. We do have a pretty decent, you know, financial position where it won't have to close the next day, but they certainly wouldn't be able to stay open indefinitely without that, you know, greater than 50% of our budget just disappearing. If that were the case, it would really be impactful across the whole nation. I'm certain there are a lot of federally qualified health centers that are even more reliant on that federal funding than ours is.
Wasn't that restored because of a court order, or was it because of some other action?
I do believe it was a court order saying that that couldn't move forward, and that it has since been rolled back, at least for federally qualified health centers. And then in this current budget that was approved through September, our funding has been secured in that realm.
Thank goodness. We were highly concerned about that. And you're one of the few agencies around that's able to provide the sliding scale help and to help those who really need help medically and in other ways. And so we really see the value in keeping those grants there for the folks who really have that big need.
Yeah, and it's really important for people like we were talking about earlier who don't have health insurance. And then unfortunately, many of us who have insurance also have a very high deductible that you would have to pay, you know, if you were ill. And so the sliding scale fee that we have is open to everybody. Anybody, whether you're insured or not, can apply for that. And if your income allows for an additional discount, that discount can then be applied to whatever, you know, your portion is in addition to your insurance, whatever individual person has to pay for their health care. Because a lot of people, you know, even if they are insured, know that the health care that they're seeking may not be covered 100%. And that is another reason that people avoid going to the doctor out of fear of those bills, not knowing how much, you know, anything is necessarily going to cost and what the coverage will be through your insurance if you have it.
And I'm just reading out of Washington, D.C. from the West Healthcare Group that the percentage of U.S. adults readily able to access and afford quality health care when they need it has dropped 6 percentage points to 55% and it's the lowest now since they began tracking healthcare affordability in 2021. And it gives the percentages of people who haven't sought out medical care because they were so afraid of the cost. And so health begins to suffer, and we get into some big-time medical difficulties when we do that. So we really appreciate hearing about your facility.
It's really unfortunate, the direction that our healthcare system has gone. You know, the cost of tests are really hard to know because everything is kind of done as a negotiation between insurance companies and whatever facility is providing the tests. And so it's very unclear. Even as a healthcare provider, I can't tell people, you know, when I send you to the pharmacy to fill this prescription, what the cost is going to be, because it's different depending on who the payer is. Similarly, when tests are ordered, whether it's blood tests or imaging tests, it's very unclear what the costs are going to be for any of those tests. And it's different for different people, depending on who your insurance is or if you're just paying cash or how it works.
I also see a big push. It goes on continually many times a day, like with people who are on Medicare to get on Medicare Advantage. And I always like to bring that up, is that there isn't, in my opinion, a very clear and complete description of maybe the differences between those two. Do you have any comments on that?
I agree with you that it's really hard to fully understand the differences between those programs. It's been my experience that Medicare Advantage is really difficult to utilize. They have a lot of restrictions on who you can see for your health care. And so some people choose those Advantage plans because they have less upfront cost. But there may be zero in-network providers near where that person lives. So then that insurance isn't useful for them because they can't access any providers that accept their insurance. They have a tremendous amount of bureaucracy built into them. You know, the unfortunate case around United Healthcare and the shooting of that CEO over the thinking is that it was about, you know, denials for coverage. The prior authorization demand that Medicare Advantage requires is so significantly higher. That's why a lot of healthcare providers don't want to take that insurance, because it creates a whole lot of bureaucracy to even get paid for the services that you're being expected to provide. And so it can look good to the consumer because the upfront cost is lower, but then your capacity to utilize that insurance to pay for the healthcare that you need becomes extremely challenging.
We had one show all about Medicare Advantage plans, and by the end of this show, we had renamed them Medicare Disadvantage plans because people could not access the healthcare they needed so very often. And so I would beware of the alarming number of commercials out there enticing people to save a dime and give up their good, solid health care. Medicare is much better. And I just wanted to mention also, we were talking about the cost of health care. Health care spending, both per person and as a share of the GDP, continues to be far higher in the United States than in other high-income countries. Yet the U.S. is the only country that doesn't have universal health coverage. The U.S. has the lowest life expectancy at birth, the highest death rates for avoidable or treatable conditions, the highest maternal and infant mortality, and among the highest suicide rates. Highest number of people with multiple chronic conditions, and obesity is nearly twice the average, We also see physicians less often than people in most other countries. And we, in general, have a reduced functional ability due to cost in many ways of accessing our health care, which again makes us want to thank your clinic for the way they're trying to combat that and trying to solve that problem. But what would you say to the many people out there that even if they have insurance, they might not be able to afford the copay or the medications?
I think we need a drastic overhaul of our healthcare system. The insurance system that has developed in the United States is benefiting its shareholders and not the population.
Amen.
It's not focused on disease prevention because it actually generates revenue when people have to use their insurance. So actually it benefits the insurer for people to get sick because then they have to go to the doctor and pay for tests and pay for medications to manage that chronic disease, whereas preventing chronic disease saves the whole money. So I think that's why we see this discrepancy between developed nations that have universal coverage have better health outcomes because it is to their benefit to prevent chronic disease, to educate people on how to eat well and exercise and focus on sleep and manage your stress so that you don't get sick. Whereas our broken healthcare system benefits from people being sick and buying expensive drugs and going to the doctor and having tests done and evaluation. It's really dysfunctional and broken. And I don't have the answer for the quick fix, but I think it really needs to be a dramatic overhaul that unfortunately, you know, we think back to what was named Obamacare was a kind of initial attempt that didn't really fix everything and then has been dismantled over the years since it was implemented so that it's, you know, currently less functional than it was at its inception.
You know, I don't know why. Well, in this case, it's a profit motive, but people are so resistant to change. I'll cite it as an example that within my lifetime, there was a new law that said people must wear seatbelts when they drive in a car and that every child must be in a seatbelt or in a child's seat. And I will never forget the uproar, the whining, the crying, the retaliating, the yelling that you can't make me. I'm free. I don't have to do what you say. And now, you know, I think that it's just a given.
And, yeah.
But the change, the acceptance of something is where we seem to break down. And I wish we had a good fix for that.
Right. It's a really beautiful example because now, I mean, I can't even imagine driving without my seatbelt or having, you know, special car seats for infants and children. Whereas I remember my mom talking about how she kind of made a little seat for my oldest brother in the floorboard of the passenger side of the vehicle so that when she was driving and it was just her and him and there was no one to hold him, that's where he went. I can't even imagine that being the reality anymore.
Yeah. Never as a child did I wear a seatbelt. And we were just fortunate we didn't get in an accident. But the death rates plummeted. You know, there's a certain outcome. If we all could pay attention to the outcomes, I think it just makes perfect common sense.
I remember driving in Mangum, Oklahoma, as a teenager with a good friend of mine, and I had to put on the brakes suddenly, and he lurched forward and broke my windshield. Luckily, it didn't cause much harm to him. We could have. But that was one example I remember from the past.
Seatbelts save lives.
And so does vaccinations and preventative care.
Yes, absolutely.
I was going to just ask also, since we've talked about expectant mothers, if a person, of course, we've already said, if you think you're going to get pregnant, get a measles vaccination beforehand, but not during. But tell us kind of what mothers who are expectant then, when should they try to see a physician? How soon should they try to get into medical care? What's your program for young mothers who are experiencing their first pregnancy?
Well, it would be, I think, the ideal scenario when people are thinking about getting pregnant is to see the doctor then, to talk about sort of what to expect with pregnancy and have a plan in place. So something that can be very beneficial to a growing fetus is additional folic acid, B12, and iron from the mother. And those things are most important before a lot of women even know they're pregnant. And so it is recommended to women as you're attempting pregnancy to start taking a prenatal vitamin then, to boost up your stores. So in those very early days where cell division is so rapid, all those extra nutrients are already present. And then your body's also used to the vitamin. And so the nausea that is so common for many women early in their pregnancy, if you try and convince someone to start taking a vitamin that might taste pretty bad and they're already nauseous and maybe throwing up, that can be a lot harder to tolerate. But if you're already used to taking it, that seems to be less challenging. Usual prenatal care starts when you're between 7 and 9 weeks of pregnancy. Although for women who are older, there are some additional tests that can be done very early in pregnancy to screen for genetic diseases and mutations that are more common with age. And so then a visit, you know, at 4 to 6 weeks of pregnancy would be the way to start your prenatal care. Usually in the beginning of pregnancy, women will have office visits once a month until they're entering their third trimester. And then the frequency of visits becomes more common to screen for pregnancy-related diseases that are more common late in pregnancy, like hypertension of pregnancy or preeclampsia, and really monitor the baby's growth and make sure that everyone's doing well. In general, we don't recommend any vaccinations during the first trimester, and it's not necessarily that they're dangerous, but we actually don't want, if there is a complication with the pregnancy, we don't want that vaccine to get blamed. But if you're pregnant during flu season and you're outside of that first trimester, getting a flu vaccination is recommended in the second and or third trimester. And that will protect your infant in addition to protecting you, especially if you breastfeed after delivery. Those antibodies get transmitted through the breast milk to protect your infant against flu when they're not old enough yet to get that vaccine. If you are eligible for a pertussis booster, that's recommended to get in the third trimester for the same reason. Then you can pass that pertussis immunity on through breast milk to the infant, as young infants are most vulnerable to severe complications from pertussis. Similarly, the newest of the vaccines that we have for RSV, there's actually an antibody rather than the vaccine that can be given to moms in the third trimester, and then they can pass that immunity on to their children through the placenta and also through breastfeeding. And then RSV vaccination is also recommended to older adults because it's a more severe disease for the very young and the very old. And then similarly to our recommendation to all humans of any age, really important self-care during pregnancy will benefit your growing baby. So access to high quality nutrition, getting adequate sleep, getting regular exercise is recommended throughout the entirety of your pregnancy. Having a social network and social support is tremendously important for reducing stress, maternal depression, and anxiety. And that is even more important after the baby is born. A new baby is a tremendous amount of work, and our individualistic society has made parenting that much harder. We need our communities to rally around young families to provide support, whether that's in the form of childcare or meal preparation or cleaning or even just social interaction for those parents who feel like they don't have anyone to talk to because all they have at home is a little baby. All of that is dramatically influential on the health and well-being of our community and our future.
Thank you, Dr. Marsh, so much. Another question, that was a great answer and suggestion to that question, but I was wondering, for those of us out here when we hear of all these illnesses, what can you do if you find that you've just been exposed to, say, the flu or measles? And how would we go about, how do you navigate a strong exposure? Is there something you can do if that's the case?
You know, it sort of depends on the illness. So, thinking about something that we've talked about over this last show is that community awareness. And so what we really thought about during the COVID pandemic and trying not to spread this contagious disease to others is staying home when you're sick, wearing a mask if you must go out, and trying to manage your symptoms without exposing other people. Measles is so very contagious that if there's concern about measles, the recommendation really, if you do need to seek healthcare, you know, is ideally for that healthcare setting to have a private room that the patient can be moved to right away that has negative air pressure that sucks the air out so that it's not exposing any more people than necessary. With viral illnesses, symptomatic treatment is really the most important thing. So if you have sinus congestion and a runny nose, clearing your nose, breathing steam, using nasal saline irrigation, doing everything that you can do, drinking lots of fluids to keep those secretions moving so they're not getting stuck, because that's then what can get complicated into a secondary bacterial ear infection or sinus infection. You know, drinking hot tea, having chicken noodle soup, resting, letting your immune system do its job and getting plenty of sleep so that it can, using over-the-counter fever reducers and pain relievers to deal with the body aches and muscle aches. Illness like influenza does have antiviral medicines that can be helpful, especially for people who have lots of other chronic diseases to help you fight off that illness, but not all viruses have antiviral medicines that are effective. So for influenza, if you start those medicines within ideally less than 72 hours, and the earlier the better after your exposure, then you're more likely to have a less severe course and get better faster. Similarly with COVID, there's an antiviral medication that can be useful to help people get better sooner. So for a lot of things, a call to your healthcare provider before you go out into the community and potentially spread these illnesses to others, talking with a nurse or provider, or even having a telehealth visit to think about what are your personal risk factors, what are the risk factors of the people in your home that might be getting exposed to this illness, how can we keep you recovering quickly, and then the rest of your family from getting sick if that's possible, and hopefully limiting spread throughout the community.
I was wondering, for the older crowd, what vaccines do you recommend, or what sort of preventive health care?
So for everybody over the age of 50, the shingles vaccine is recommended. Shingles is the reactivation of the chickenpox virus. So for people who are immunized against varicella or the chickenpox, they hopefully will never get shingles. But people who are currently 50 or older didn't have the opportunity to have the varicella vaccine. And so that is recommended for everybody over the age of 50. Also at that age group, for people who have chronic lung disease, getting a pneumococcal vaccine can be beneficial to prevent pneumonia. The influenza, and at this point, we are probably on the realm of having an annual COVID booster, is recommended annually for everybody once a year, ideally in the fall. I mentioned before a tetanus and pertussis booster every 10 years. The new RSV vaccine is recommended for adults age 60 and older. I think I'm trying to find my immunization schedule here. I feel like RSV might be eligible for younger people if you have some chronic diseases. And then the pneumococcal vaccine also for everybody age 65 and older has a series of two shots that you can get for that. And that might be the whole list.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. We really appreciate, since, of course, we've been hearing the Gallup study that cost is named as the most urgent healthcare problem in the U.S. But even at that, many Americans rate their own healthcare positively, as do we. And so for those listening in Bozeman and the area around, could you tell us how to get in touch with you, if there's a website, a phone number, and tell us where you're located in Bozeman, so that somebody could just head right on over if they needed to?
So Community Health Partners in Bozeman is located on Shockey Lane, which is to the east of Lowe's between Baxter and Oak Street. The phone number is 406-585-1360. And at that location, we have a pharmacy, medical providers, dental office, as well as a behavioral health team with counselors and psychiatry. Our Belgrade office is located right on Main Street. The Belgrade office only provides medical and behavioral health support, but they're at 19 East Main Street at 406-924-5754. And then we also have our clinic in Livingston, which provides full service care. So they also have pharmacy, dental, medical, and behavioral health. And that's at 112 West Lewis Street. And it's 406-222-1111. And then all of the offices, I didn't mention that, have the resource coordination. So a special person to help people kind of work through the marketplace, if they're in the market for insurance, see if they would qualify for Medicaid, can help with navigating the Medicare system, and then help people access our sliding fee scale, as well as resources in the community, you know, like the connecting you with the food bank, helping navigate streamline services, helping people be aware of, you know, what other resources are out there to support health and well-being of our community.
Just excellent. Thank you. We We also wanted to look at another aspect. We read that there's a shortage of medical personnel. And if you could talk a little bit about your journey to become a physician, about medical school, and talk to those out there who might be thinking about it. For instance, we had one friend who retired from the military with an early 20-year retirement. He was in his 40s, and he was accepted into medical school, and he was thrilled. He said, I'll be able to work another 15 or 20 years after I get out. He was very healthy. So, you know, it's not just young people, but could you talk a little bit about the need for medical training and more professionals and how you became involved, please?
Yeah, it is a really big deal. And unfortunately, since the pandemic, there was a big exodus of people from healthcare because of overwhelm and stress and worry about their own personal health. We lost a lot of healthcare professionals since the pandemic, and we have not yet recovered. I had an experience as a very young child that really kind of enamored me with the idea of medicine, and my older brother got very sick, and I really felt like his doctor saved his life. And then I was someone who was kind of drawn to the sciences throughout my education, and medicine really fell in line with that. I did work for a few years after medical school, after my undergraduate degree, before I went to medical school. And where I went to school at Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland, Oregon, I think they kind of liked people who had some life experience and weren't going just straight through school. So that's interesting to hear about your friend at 40 and kind of a second career going into medicine. It definitely is something that is open to everybody. And I think that life experience and maturity really helps people to feel more confident in the vulnerable role that you take as a healthcare provider in providing care for other humans. OHSU is really focused on training primary care physicians and has a really strong focus on connecting people with primary care professions, family medicine, internal medicine, pediatrics, as well as the subspecialties. I stayed in the Portland area for my residency in family medicine, which is 3 years, and then worked at a federally qualified health center that was really targeting migrant health workers outside of Portland as my first job. But when I started a family, we decided that we didn't like living in the city so much anymore, and that's what brought us to Bozeman, a place where we could have the community that we wanted and access to the wonderful outdoor things that we enjoy doing as well. And I really wanted to stay in the federally qualified health center realm. And that was kind of one of those must-haves for my family as we were looking at places to live, is choosing a place that had a federally qualified health center for my career. And I've been here since 2009, growing my family and growing my career and practicing medicine. In Bozeman, we've really struggled with our own staffing, you know, at all levels. Unfortunately, we've had some turnover at the provider level. We have a shortage of nurses, medical assistants, administrative folks, which has really proved very challenging to continue to provide the high quality care that we want to provide to the community. We aren't actually accepting new patients in Bozeman right now until we get our staffing kind of recollected, but the other sites of Community Health Partners in Belgrade and Livingston are accepting patients, and they could transfer their care to Bozeman once we get our staffing up and trained again. But it's been a real challenge over the last 5 years since the pandemic. Healthcare has become very difficult to provide for lots of different reasons.
And we'd like to invite anyone out there thinking of becoming a physician or an assistant to help and jump in there. And I think that we're just about out of time, but we really can't thank you enough, Dr. Myers. We hope to have you on again soon.
Thank you,
Dr.
Myers.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's KGVM. Listen to us every chance you get. We'll see you next time. Thank you.